Turn with me, please, to 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 9 to 11 is our text. On the website of the Canadian government, there's a large section that's all about the country's national parks. And within that large section on the national parks, there's a fairly large section that has this title, Safe Travel in Bear Country. And the stuff in that section then is very detailed. The first main heading is, if you see a bear. That's then followed by two subheadings. Is the bear unaware of your presence? Is the bear aware of your presence? Next main heading, if the bear approaches. Again, there are two subheadings. Is it defensive? Is it non-defensive? Next main heading is handling an attack. The first subheading there is defensive attack. That, by the way, includes the advice, play dead, which I thought was quite interesting. The second subheading is predatory attack, where you're told, and I quote, to fight back, intimidate the bear, shout, hit it with a branch or rock, do whatever it takes to let the bear know you're not easy prey. Now, to us living in the UK, this kind of stuff sounds crazy, doesn't it? I mean, for us, removing a spider from the bath is a big deal. And we might almost think then that someone is having a laugh there. The whole thing's just a spoof. It's tongue-in-cheek. But no, it's not. The Canadian government, it's not engaging in a bit of light-hearted fun. Its advice there to walkers and campers out and about in the national parks is absolutely serious. You need to be ready for a battle with a bear. And the Apostle Peter has some similar advice for his Christian readers. In verse 8 that we looked at last time, he talks about a roaring lion who is seeking someone to devour. And this morning's text then begins verse 9, resist him. Resist him. Peter is saying to his Christian readers, you need to be ready for a battle with a lion. Which of course would be scary enough if Peter were talking here in ordinary zoological terms, but he's not. He doesn't have in mind here an African lion or an Asiatic lion. He has in mind something vastly more formidable than either of those, the devil, Satan. He's the most powerful and aggressive and voracious lion of them all. The ones you find in the savannas of sub-Saharan Africa, they're mere pussycats. Compared with this lion, and Peter is saying, we need to be ready for a battle with him. And as with the website that I mentioned then, I suppose we might at first think that Peter is just being playful here. So you're joking, right, Peter? I mean, I'm just an ordinary guy who wears a cardigan and a pair of slippers and sits in an armchair doing the crossword and sipping a cup of tea. You're not really expecting me to do battle with a lion, to get into combat with the devil. But no, Peter isn't joking any more than the Canadian government is joking. He too is absolutely serious. And this is something then that all of us this morning must get to grips with. As Christian men and women and boys and girls, our calling is to be lion fighters. Conversion to Christ propels us into a lifelong conflict. A lifelong conflict with the devil. Resist him, Peter says. That's your task, Christian. That's my task today and tomorrow and the next day and every day until Jesus Christ returns or perhaps we die first. Our task is strenuously to resist this mighty foe. And playing dead, by the way, is not an option. But you're probably at this point on the brink of despair, and you're thinking, well, look, Dan, if I want bad news, I can go to the BBC website for bad news. I don't come to church on a Sunday morning to be discouraged and depressed. So let me change the tone. Because Peter changes the tone. And what he does actually in the rest of this text is this. He provides encouragements for this business of resisting the devil. He provides several encouragements, and I've summed up each one of them this morning with a particular word. And so encouragement number one then, my word is simplicity. Simplicity. What does successfully resisting the devil entail? Is it once you've planted a certain number of churches that you can be said to have resisted the devil? Is it once you've led a certain number of people to Christ? Is it once you've mastered a certain selection of the greatest theological works? Is resisting the devil complex? Does it involve meeting this criterion and that criterion and the next criterion and ticking this box and that box and the next box? Well, the answer is no. No, it's simple, actually. Now, don't confuse the word simple with the word easy. That would be a mistake. By definition, doing battle with a lion cannot be easy. No, resisting the devil is not easy, but it is simple. Because it really just involves one thing that can be expressed in five words, remaining firm in your faith. Remaining firm in your faith. Resist him, Peter says, firm in your faith. He's describing there what resisting him looks like, what it consists in. And it consists, he is saying, in this, remaining firm in your faith. You see, your faith is the devil's great target. I've talked in these last couple of sermons about Peter's own experience, because Peter's own experience, I think, very much forms the backdrop to this fifth chapter of the letter. And I've referred then, you may remember, to that warning which Jesus gave to Peter in the upper room. It's recorded for us in Luke 22. That warning, Peter, Satan wants to have you. But Jesus, in that moment, doesn't just warn Peter. Do you remember the other thing that he says? He says, but I have prayed for you. I've prayed for you. Prayed what? I have prayed for you, he says, that your faith may not fail. That's what Jesus has prayed. And Jesus has prayed that, presumably, for this reason: Satan is trying to make Peter's faith fail. That's what he's after. That's his aim. That's his goal. This is the time of year when lots of Wimbledon illustrations creep into my sermons. And at Wimbledon, then, you get some players, and for them, qualifying at all for the competition and just being there is amazing. And anything that they can achieve while they're there is a bonus. If in the first round they can win a set, just one set, as they're being knocked out by a much better opponent, well, they'll be chuffed to bits with that. Other players, perhaps, they have their sights set a bit higher than that. They want to try to get through a few rounds of Wimbledon. But if they can do that then, and if they can not get knocked out until the back end of week one, or perhaps even the front end of week two, then they'll be over the moon with that. I'm saying a lot of participants in the Wimbledon Championships, they have modest ambitions. And we can wrongly think as Christians that Satan has modest ambitions. And that if he can tempt you into telling a lie at work tomorrow, or if he can tempt you into speaking crossly to your spouse when you return from work tomorrow, then he's cracking open the champagne and celebrating wildly. That massively underestimates our enemy. In Wimbledon terms, Satan isn't that British player ranked 749th in the world who's happy to play in front of three spectators on court 17. No, Satan is Alcaraz. Satan is Djokovic. Those guys don't have modest ambitions. They are after nothing less than going home from Wimbledon with the trophy. And the devil is after nothing less than ending your faith. Ending it. Finishing it. Terminating it. That's what he wants. He won't throw a party because of an odd sin committed here and there in your life. He wants you an unbeliever. He wants you an ex-Christian. He wants you done altogether with following Jesus Christ. He keeps the champagne on ice because he's hoping that that day will come and then he'll celebrate. Your faith, I'm saying, is the devil's great target, which means then that, as I say, successfully resisting the devil is simply remaining firm in your faith. It's that little line that was there in our second hymn this morning. He who dies believing. He who dies believing. That's the name of the game. To reach that point when you're breathing your last, you're in your final moments of mortal life, and you're still a Christian. Being a Christian wasn't a phase that you went through for a decade or two. It wasn't a chapter of your life which at some point gave way to another. No, at conversion, you helplessly threw yourself on the finished work of Jesus Christ, and that's where you stayed. Fixed there, lodged there through all the ensuing years, right up to the bitter end, leaning on the Saviour. That's what it's all about. That's the name of the game. And when that happens then, when someone dies believing, Satan groans a terrible groan. I remember years ago watching a nature program, and it featured remarkable footage of a polar bear taking on walruses, if walruses is the plural of walrus, I think it is. And there were a whole load of walruses then resting on the shore, and this very hungry polar bear came along, and it tried to pick, I guess, one of the more vulnerable looking of the walruses on this stony beach, and it got into a tussle with it. But walruses are pretty big and strong creatures, and those tusks that they have are pretty scary things, and the polar bear then couldn't get the better of this walrus, so it moved on to another one, and it was overcome again in the tussle with it, and it just tried attacking quite a few of these walruses, but in each case to no avail. And I remember clearly the shot of the polar bear leaving the walruses. And maybe it was just my imagination, maybe it was David Attenborough's melodramatic commentary in the background, but to me that bear just looked very, very crestfallen indeed, having to give up after all that effort and walk away with an empty stomach. And that's how I picture Satan in the moment that a Christian dies. All through that Christian's life, he is attacked and attacked, day in, day out, seeking to devour that person. But now that Christian has died, still believing, and there's nothing Satan can do anymore. He just has to give up and walk away with an empty stomach, looking like that polar bear, his shoulders slumped, his tail between his legs. That's how I picture Satan on that day 12 months ago when our dear brother Mike died, and on the day that Alan McKechnie died, and when Ken died, and so many that we could mention. Because these people, they die firm in their faith. All the years of their Christian lives, the lion hadn't managed to devour them. They resisted him and resisted him. And I'm saying then that if you can lie on your deathbed one day, still a Christian believer, you too will have resisted him. Simple as that. By that stage, your youthful beauty may be no more. By that stage, your mental clarity may be no more. By that stage, your earning power may be no more. Lots of things may be no more, but as long as your faith is still attached to the crucified and risen Jesus Christ, that's all that matters. Dying believing is a triumph, an epic, epic triumph, which sends waves of anguish through all the powers of darkness. And so that's one encouragement in this business of resisting the devil: simplicity. There's one simple thing involved, and that is remaining firm in your faith until your very last breath and being able to die believing. Simplicity. Secondly, solidarity. Solidarity. Resist him. Firm in your faith, Peter says, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. Now you might wonder a little bit about the logic here. Peter suddenly brings suffering into the equation. What does suffering have to do with all of this? Well, I said then just now that the devil wants to make a Christian's faith fail. And this is the thing. When a Christian is suffering, and especially when a Christian is suffering precisely because he or she is a Christian, that's a great opportunity for the devil. It's a great opportunity for him to use this kind of temptation. Dear Christian, you're stubbornly following Jesus there day after day after day, and all it's bringing you is suffering and pain and difficulty. But you know, it doesn't have to be like that. You could just abandon Jesus. You could quit following him. And then you would have a pleasant, easy, comfortable life. It's a no-brainer, isn't it? That is one key way in which the devil attacks. That's essentially how he attacked Peter, isn't it? In the very early hours of Good Friday, he tempted Peter with the alluring possibility of denying all knowledge of Jesus in that courtyard, the alluring possibility of thereby escaping the suffering that might come if he admitted that he was Jesus' disciple. The alluring possibility of being disloyal to Jesus, yes, but in that way, being able to go home that night safe and free to his wife and family. That's how he attacked Peter. And doubtless he was trying to get at Peter's readers of this letter in a similar way. I've said so often during this series that they were on the receiving end, it seems, of abuse from hostile unbelievers. And doubtless Satan was tempting them then. He was tempting them with the alluring possibility of just pulling the plug on their Christian discipleship and in a stroke ending all the hostility. Your pagan neighbours won't say things about you then. Not if you just pull the plug. Not if you just quit. Throw in the towel. Life will be easy then. You won't be ostracised. You won't be discriminated against. You won't be marginalised. You won't be made to look stupid. Satan was no doubt getting at Peter's readers in that way, and they would have been finding that hard then. Suffering. And in their suffering, being tempted by the devil to opt for an easier path. But you see, Peter here in this last part of verse 9, he's encouraging them in this way. He's saying, look, you're not alone. You're not alone. As you suffer, and as you feel the power of that satanic temptation to be done with suffering by being done with Christ, as you feel that and feel the power of that, you are in solidarity with countless brothers and sisters throughout the world. And that kind of encouragement does make a difference, doesn't it? This time of year is the time of year that exams take place. It's also, of course, the time of year when the days are long and often the weather is quite good, which means then that every GCSE student and every A-level student and every university student is confronted with a choice. The choice between sitting at a desk revising, which is tiring and boring and stressful, or going to the beach where it's fun and relaxing and there's no tiredness and no boredom and no stress. But here's the question. When is it most hard to choose the revision rather than the beach? Well, it's most hard, isn't it, when pretty much everyone you know has already finished their exams. And they definitely are at the beach lounging around there, but you still have one exam left. That's when it's hard. Because you see, as long as you know that lots of others are sharing your pain, and they're also having to say no to the beach, then it's manageable for you to say no to the beach. That sense of solidarity helps, but when the sense of solidarity is no longer there, then it becomes really, really, really hard. And that's then why Peter is making this point here in verse 9. And he's showing his readers that there are lots of others sharing with their pain in saying no to apostasy, saying no to ditching Christ for an easier life. And Peter then is hoping that that sense of solidarity will help. And if then the thought crosses your mind this week or any week, my peers would accept me as a normal human being if I just quit being a Christian. It's all it would take. And that thought seems a hard thought for you to cope with. Remember that there are lots of other Christians around the world who are also facing similar thoughts and having to battle against them. In fact, for many of them, it isn't just my peers would accept me as a normal human being if I quit being a Christian. For many of them, I might be able to earn a living if I quit being a Christian. I might be able to be released from prison if I quit being a Christian. I might be able to save my life from execution if I quit being a Christian. It's a whole different level for many of our brothers and sisters throughout the world this morning. And so let that put your situation into perspective as you resist the devil and you say, no, I'm not going to choose my peers' acceptance. I'm going to choose carrying on being a Christian, thank you very much. As I remember that many of my brothers and sisters are making that same choice in far harder circumstances than I am. So encouragement number one, simplicity. Encouragement number two, solidarity. Encouragement number three, superiority. Superiority, by which I mean this. By carrying on being a Christian, you will gain something far superior to the pleasant, easy life the devil is tempting you to exchange for being a Christian. That's what verse 10 is about, where Peter says, after you have suffered a little while, God is going to restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. What's Peter talking about there? Well, he uses those four verbs: restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish. The first one and the last one both have an architectural flavor to them. So that word establish, the last verb he uses, it literally means lay a foundation, which is, of course, what you do when constructing a building. The first verb that he uses, restore, that's used in the Greek Old Testament, in the book of Ezra, several times, of Jerusalem's walls and temple being restored following the Babylonian exile. Now, it's interesting, isn't it, to think of the Apostle Paul's writing. And we were going to sing as our third hymn this morning a paraphrase of 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And in the first few verses of 2 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul, he similarly talks about something that is going to happen to us believers one day, and he uses architectural imagery. And it's very clear there exactly what's in view. He talks in that passage about what is mortal being swallowed up by life, 2 Corinthians 5 verse 4. In other words, he's talking there about bodily resurrection and glorification. And he describes then the Christian's body in its present state as a tent. It's just a flimsy, flappy tent, a piece of canvas. But you see, on that last day, the tent is going to be massively upgraded. And it's going to become a building, Paul says there. A robust, imperishable resurrection body. And it's likely then that when Peter uses the same kind of architectural imagery here, he also has the same kind of thing in view. Notice in the same breath, he talks, doesn't he, about eternal glory. And glory then in the New Testament, when glory is described as something that we receive, normally it's resurrection glory that's in view. And so I want you to understand from this then, believer, what a future you have. Perhaps you're feeling very much this morning the frailty of your body, the way that it's declined so much over the years and the decades, so that now just functioning each day is a struggle. Getting up in the morning, which once you did without a thought, it's now challenging and exhausting. Climbing the stairs, which once you took two at a time, now it's like climbing Mount Everest. Well, hear what Peter is saying to you in this text. He's saying God is going to restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish that decrepit body of yours. He's going to take that body and he's going to pour glory into its every limb and its every organ and its every cell. Wow. And the point is then that that everlasting reward that lies ahead of us, it's way superior to the easy life that we'll get now if we quit being a Christian. Yes, things might be easier for a few years, for a few decades, until we go into the grave or Christ comes. But Peter is saying, I've got something way, way superior to a few years of easier living. And that is resurrection glory. That's what you have lined up for you if you persevere in this Christian life. And you might be thinking then, well, how do I know that God is going to do this? How do I know he will resurrect me and glorify me? Well, Peter's answer is because he is the God of all grace. And that's just a wonderful phrase to kind of take out of the verse and ponder on in and of itself, isn't it? A beautiful description of our God. But here I think Peter specifically means this then, that notice he says he's the God of all grace who has called you. And Peter's readers then, they would have been very aware that they'd been called by God. As we've said so often, as I mentioned in my prayer earlier, being called by God in New Testament terms, that's not a polite invitation from God. That is a powerful summons from God. When God calls someone into Christ, there's something in the call that actually produces the very thing that it's asking for. A bit like Jesus' call to dead Lazarus. A call which Lazarus couldn't possibly obey. He couldn't even hear it. He was dead, for goodness sake. But that call contained within itself the power to make the thing happen that it was calling for. And when God calls someone out of darkness into light, out of Adam into Christ, out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of Jesus, the call itself contains the power that will make the thing happen. And Peter's readers, as I say, they knew that had happened to them. These were people who we discovered in chapter 4 had been going to orgies and drinking parties and all kinds of things before they became Christians. You don't suddenly go from that to being a Christian just in a natural evolutionary way. If you go from the orgies and the drinking parties to suddenly worshipping Jesus Christ and living a holy life, that's because some supernatural intervention has taken place. They knew that God had powerfully, irresistibly called them. And so they knew that they'd experienced that form of divine grace, God calling them. But Peter is saying, you see, God doesn't just have one form of grace up his sleeve. No, he's the God of all grace. That is to say, when God decides to make you the beneficiary of his grace, you don't just get a little stream of grace, you get grace galore. Not just him calling you, but him lavishing upon you the whole package of blessings. In the language of Romans 8, with which we began our service, calling you, justifying you, glorifying you. Peter is saying, God's grace has clearly already gotten you guys in its clutches. Hence, you've been called out of darkness into Christ. Well, it ain't going to stop now. He's the God of all grace. He won't be done with you until every salvation blessing is yours and you have been bodily restored, confirmed, strengthened, and established. And so resist the devil, believer, understanding that you have something in store immeasurably superior to anything that the devil can offer you. The devil can offer you a lot in this world's terms, perhaps. But you have something in store that isn't in this world's terms. You have resurrection glory in store. The God who has called you and shown his grace to you in that way is the God of all grace, not just calling grace, but justifying grace and glorifying grace. And if you've had one part of his grace, you'll have to have all the rest as well. No one just gets a bit of it. And so, believer, be encouraged to resist the devil, focusing your eyes on what lies ahead. Encouragement number one, simplicity. Encouragement number two, solidarity. Encouragement number three, superiority. And then briefly, encouragement number four, sovereignty. Sovereignty. One more Wimbledon illustration. So a player is playing there, and that player's coach can do a lot before the match and can give a lot of advice, a lot of coaching, a lot of tips, a lot of techniques, a lot of help. But there's something, isn't there, that's always outside of the coach's control, and that is how the opponent will perform. The opponent could come and have a terrible performance. The opponent could come and play like no one has ever played in history. And your coach can't control what the opponent is going to do. And is it a bit like that here then? So God can tell us how to resist the devil. And he can give us lots of tips and lots of advice and lots of encouragements for doing that. But there's one thing that's outside of God's control, and that is how the devil's going to perform. And if the devil pulls off a real blinder, and if he really, really rises to the heights, then he might be able to fell us after all. Well, this is where I think verse 11 comes in, where Peter finishes this section. To him be the dominion forever and ever, it says. There's no actual verb there in the Greek text. You have to supply the verb yourself. The ESV translators have gone for be. I think it'd be better belong, or is, if you like. Back in chapter 4, verse 11, we had an almost identical verse. And there the verb is supplied by Peter, and it is belong. To him belong dominion. And probably then Peter assumes the same thing here in our text. So to him belongs the dominion, or is the dominion, forever and ever. So this is not a prayer, this is a statement. And it's the dominion then. The rule, the sovereignty. And Peter doesn't narrow that down at all. It's just absolute and total and exhaustive. God has the dominion, Peter's saying, over absolutely everything. And what has Peter just been talking about in the previous few verses? The roaring lion, the devil. And Peter wants us to understand, therefore, he has the dominion over him. Our opponent is not outside of our God's control, like the tennis player's opponent is outside of his coach's control. Our opponent is absolutely within our God's control. And sometimes then when that roaring lion comes bounding toward us, all we can see is this lion looking so free and so rampant. What we can't see is that behind the lion there's a chain. And at the other end of that chain is the hand of our Heavenly Father. And he has the lion on his chain. And as soon as he wishes, he can yank that chain and pull the lion off us before the lion can maul us to death. And we need to always be clear on this. It's possible, of course, to underestimate the power of Satan. He is a roaring lion. And we must take the threat seriously. But it's also possible to overestimate the power of Satan and to regard Satan as in some in-between status, so that you have the infinite God up there, you have creatures down here, and Satan is somewhere in between. No, he's not somewhere in between. He's down there with us. He's a creature. He's as dependent on God for every single moment of his continued existence as you are, and as the woodlouse that runs along your kitchen floor is. He's a creature. In God, he lives and moves and has his being. If God stops him existing, he stops existing. He has no independent source of existence. He's a creature. As one theologian in the 20th century put it, the next thing less than the infinite is infinitely less. And Satan is not infinite like God. He's a creature like us. And God has him on a lead. And God is in absolute control of him. And so, we needn't fear. We should be serious, vigilant, watchful, sober-minded, but not fearful, not paralyzed with terror. Because our enemy is under the control of our God. And we can, therefore, look forward to that wonderful future that is ours. That's a significant aspect, isn't it, of what we're about to do now, eating the bread and drinking the wine. We perhaps forget that and we solely look back. But a big part of this meal is looking forward. These are little tokens of a banquet that lies ahead. And we needn't fear that before we're able to get our teeth into the real banquet, Satan is going to derail us. Because God is in control, and he's more powerful than Satan. And we can therefore eat and drink this morning with assurance that the place at the table, the heavenly table that has my name on it, your name on it, won't be empty on that day. It will be occupied. You'll be there. I'll be there because of our powerful, keeping God. May he bless his word to us. Amen.